Michelle here, high in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. This is the Doctor Who Podcast, and you are most welcome.
Hello, and welcome to episode 102 of the Doctor Who Podcast. It's closing time, and like the Doctor, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Another episode of the Doctor Who Podcast. Welcome one and all to quite possibly is the best Doctor Who podcast in existence. With me here this week to talk about closing time, not the song, but the Doctor Who episode, is my good friend Tom. Hang on, mate.
Not so bad. It's nice to actually be here after being away for far too long. It's nice to be in my own chair in the camper van again.
Back where you should be with me. But unfortunately, no James again this week.
Yes, I know. I mean, that banging is getting a bit more insistent from the basement, but it's okay. I'll let him out next week, maybe.
I'm sure he'll be back for the finale in one form or another. Wild horses couldn't drag him away.
No, not at all. So, James, wherever you are, if you're listening, and we hope that you are, we hope you're having a great time. Take care, man. But that said, where he is, he can't get Doctor Who. He can't get Doctor Who on a Saturday night. Where we are, we can. So, you know, it swings in roundabouts.
Yes, we are here today to talk about Closing Time, the penultimate episode of Series 6, or Series 6B, or the one before Series 7, whatever you want to call it. And let's get right into it, hey?
Well then, old girl. One last trip, eh?
Hey. I'm the Doctor. I was here to help. And you are very, very welcome.
Tom, as per usual, I would love to hear what you thought of Closing Time.
One of the joys of having a show which has returned seemingly from the dead to the present day as a gift, unopened and ready to be consumed by an eager generation of new fans, is that for the people who have experienced it before, every episode that is produced by similar fans can become a love letter to the things that we remember and love about the show. For instance, a Cyberman story, as we all know from the old days, should be creepy and scary. And the Cybermen themselves shouldn't be lumbering Frankensteins. They should be actually pathetic, terrifyingly sad creatures who are only trying to survive. And what we've got in this particular show is the continuing reinvention of the Doctor as a new and mysterious and dangerous and sad and melancholy character, just as he was in 1963. We've also got, on the way to that reinvention, an evocation of all of the companions. We'll get into this later, I hope, but the visit of K-9, the references to K-9, the references to Rose, to Donna, to Martha, and to any of the other companions who are kind of obvious in here, were so pleasing to see. To get the feel of the show again and with the return of the Cybermats, to get the idea that the Doctor is lonely, is sad, and to see why he travels with humans. So a reinvention of the myth was absolutely gorgeous. The real return of characters like Craig, and of course the aching sadness of seeing Amy and Rory just getting on with their lives, not as if the Doctor was never there, but in the way that you see a past partner just waltzing through life, happy, secure and complete, even though you're not part of them anymore, adds real pathos and weight to these characters. To see actors returning, like Linda Barron, because her line is writ large through Doctor Who, is also incredibly rewarding. But the word I would use about this is reward. This is about payoff. For fans of the show since 2005 until now, there are enough references for you to pick up on to feel happy that you're a long-term Doctor Who fan. There are references from this season with the I Speak Baby that again are rewarding if you've just followed this season. But over and above all of that, for me, there are rewards for saying I've followed this story since 1963, or I'm aware of it for this amount of time, and the references to Cybermen stories and companions make it great for me. I like the physical comedy. I like the Laurel and Hardy act that's going on there. I don't think anyone could have missed that. You know, Matt Smith as the Beanpole and James Corden as Oliver Hardy just worked really, really well. And although I'm seeing complaints on the internet that, oh, it's too emotional, love conquers all again, do you know what? That's what the best drama does. You get involved. And for me, although I didn't know what was going to happen, I thought, is Corden going to get converted? How's the Doctor going to feel about this? Because he's failed again. To see the way that it was resolved was fine by me. Some of the stories from the 60s are that simplistic, but we just put it down to when they were recorded. To be honest with you, I think anyone watching this in 10, 15 years' time will have a warm, happy, fuzzy glow about it, because, yeah, the resolution is simple, but the journey towards that resolution is actually quite emotional. And, you know, we'll talk about it later on, I hope, but the last 5 minutes as well also start to put a cap on what was going on at the very beginning of the season and all the way back to season four. So what did I think of it? I thought it was great. Is it good Doctor Who? It's brilliant Doctor Who. I don't want to say that's the best episode of this season so far, because I find myself saying it every week, but to me that is Doctor Who. I'm glad to see it.
Well, I'm not sure where to begin, Tom. I'm sorry. There are some parts of that I do agree with, but unfortunately at the end of the day, I found this a very unsatisfying episode for a couple of reasons. I'm sure there were people who were watching this who were looking forward to a Cyberman story. That's what some of the teasers told you. That's what the Next Time trailer tried to build up. But what we get is a horrible misuse of the Cyberman or Cybus race or whatever you want to call them, whatever they're called in this universe now. And I suppose an even more criminal reintroduction of the Cybermats to a new generation. Now, for many, the Cybermats are quite chilling little creatures, and for a while there, I thought, oh, they're really doing justice to these little metal, you know, rat things. Then they showed a Cybermat with teeth, and I went, okay, why does a Cybermat have teeth? But anyway, that's beside the point. I wasn't particularly thrilled with this story because it was a criminal underuse of the Cybermen. I thought it could have been any possible ancient spaceship buried under the earth that has these creatures coming out of it to, you know, sap energy so they could start taking over the world. I was nowhere near happy with the resolution of the story. I thought it was incredibly rushed. Everything over within 1 minute, you know, suddenly they're all up in the department store going, well, that was good. You know, we've solved the problem. Love conquers all. You know, let's fade to end credits. It reminded me of all the worst aspects of the ending for Victory of the Daleks. And I know that you love that story, Tom. I know that's, I think, your favourite story from Series 5. Yeah. But for me, that was one of my least favourite stories from Series 5. And the whole resolution with love or strong emotion overcoming obstacles in the story didn't really work for me. Now, I know that's been a little bit of a running theme this year with regards to that, but I wasn't a fan of it in this story. Possibly because I think it was so rushed that we had spent a long time in the story building up to this, that then they resolved the whole problem with the spaceship underneath the ground very, very quickly. Really, really quick. I was surprised at the breathtaking speed with which James Corden was uncybernized, or there's been a feedback loop, or that's going to cause a massive explosion. Quick, let's get out of here. Everything blows up. End of story. That probably contributed a lot to my dissatisfaction with this. Having said that, I did enjoy what I now realise was the main thrust of the story, the Doctor's journey, or the Doctor's continuing journey with his emotions in this story. He has a very fatalistic view at the moment, that he seems like his journey's about to come to an end. He knows that his next journey is to Lake Silencio, where he is going to die. So that does cast a very sort of Legopolis pall over this entire story, because he never really raises himself out of his own self-imposed melancholy, despite some of the more, as you say, Laurel and Hardy moments in this. I think the use of the Cybermen was probably a misstep. I would have preferred just an ordinary monster, because all they were really there for was just to provide a little bit of menace,
right,
to the story. I think it was a waste for the Cybermen to be used. And I'm not happy with the resolution, but I am happy because the last couple of minutes with River Song seem to be leading to a very exciting series conclusion.
Okay, do you know what? I think you're entitled to your opinion, as wrong as it is. but maybe we should go through, because there's an awful lot of stuff there. Maybe we should go through a couple of key things and we can discuss them.
All right.
Right, first thing, the first thing. I think you're right. The reason I liked Victory of the Daleks was because I'm never going to be able to see The Power of the Daleks, which is Patrick Troughton's first episode in the role of the Doctor. So I loved that someone who equally loves the show wrote The Power of the Daleks and put it into season 5. I'm really grateful for that. In the same way, there are bits of the moon base or bits of 10th Planet or bits of Team of the Cybermen we can watch, but certainly The Wheel in Space, all of these early Cybermen stories that set the Cybermen up, as I mentioned earlier, not as faceless pounding Frankenstein goon, which is what they certainly what they became in the 70s and almost through the 80s, but they were really very, very sad, heartless, lost characters who just had to change the world, you know, just like effectively cybernetic creatures gone wrong, rogue. They had no emotion, but they had almost, the logic that they lived on was just so fatally flawed that it was utterly pathetic, like Frankenstein's monster. Nothing evil inside Frankenstein's monster itself, but just the way it went about its life, the way, you know, the fact of its existence at all was truly appalling and quite terrifying. And that's the truth of the Cybermen, that these Cybermen are skulking in the shadows, just like they were in the moon base. That these Cybermen are grabbing people quietly, one by one, in a totally inefficient and pathetic way, just like they were in the Wheel in Space. It's wonderful for me because I get a sense of what the show was about. To see the Cybermats again. I know they have teeth, but you know what? If I'm 12 years old, that scares me. It made me jump when I first saw it. It's like a little metal piranha.
You know, I agree with all you're saying. I mean, it's fantastic to have the Cybermen back. That shot of the store attendant coming across the Cybermen in the changing room. I thought suddenly we were going to be getting a modern equivalent of the Dalek rising out of the Thames. What the heck is a Dalek having a bath in the Thames for? What the heck is a Cyberman doing in a human changing room? But that was explained later, unfortunately. I thought they might have left that dangling as a sort of modern equivalent to a Dalek invasion of Earth. But anyway, it was great to have the Cybermats back. It really was. And for the most part, they were menacing. I don't know. I just feel at the end of the day that unless you're going to devote a story to them, then what's the point of having them there? They are even more so in the modern era of Doctor Who. Very, you know, second-rate Doctor Who monsters.
No, you're wrong. You're totally wrong. The Cybermen were the best monster Doctor Who ever conceived, apart from the Nymon. The Cybermen were number one, way ahead of the Daleks, because one, they could climb stairs, and number two, they really couldn't be reasoned with. The Daleks, you could kind of, it seemed like you could talk them round if you were careful. But the Cybermen, juggernaut, man.
I'm talking more from the viewpoint that, sure, they were bought into the classic series with wonderful menace. I mean, you look at stuff they did in 10th Planet, for example. That is an incredible story, even though we can't see one episode. But then you get, by the time you get to the 80s, and you've got characters lopping their heads off with swords, and they're really, really badly treated.
Yes.
And I still feel that the Cybermen in the modern era seem to be the sort of, I don't know, second-rate cousins of the real Cybermen from the classic era. They never really seem to have stepped up and made the Cybermen role their own, I suppose. I mean, that's a weird thing to say. It seems like the Cybermen are still struggling to get out of that rut they're in.
Well, these Cybermen are, to me anyway, are true to the original ideal of the classic series Cybermen, in as much as the Cybermen created themselves. It was only bit by bit they lost their humanity. And that's very much what's going on here. I mean, as much as there's a renaissance for the Doctor, and we should really talk about the Doctor in this episode, as much as there's a renaissance for the Doctor himself and his own relationship with his universe and his companions, I think this story, to me, hopefully marks the beginning of a renaissance for the Cybermen too. No more the comedy strong-arm robots that we've seen over the last few years, but something scary, a bit sad, and very, very menacing. They were The logic with which they pushed Craig into that fat Cyberman suit, which has got to be a reference to the fat cyber controller from the 80s, was, you know, it's just like, well, we're going to convert you. You will be like us. Which is just beautiful to hear that phrase again. And also to hear that Wheel in Space phrase, you know our ways. I don't think it was actually quoted word for word, but it was very, very close. And that's enough for a dyed-in-the-wool fan like me to get goose pimples. And I was frankly jumping for joy thinking, hooray, it's the Cyberman.
Well, while we're on the classic series references, and I know we've had some feedback recently from some listeners who actually enjoy playing a little drinking game, I think, to try and predict what classic series references we're going to make. One other one I wanted to mention was a very brief one right at the beginning of the episode, was an almost exact quote from the Five Doctors.
And who is this?
It's Colonel Crichton, my replacement.
Ah. Yes, mine was pretty unpromising, too.
Come along, Doctor. We'll take a stroll round the ground, shall we? awfully sorry about this. Do excuse me for a moment.
You've had this place redecorated, haven't you? Don't like it.
Come along, Doctor.
That brought back to me memories of the Five Doctors instantly.
You're right, it's the Five Doctors and it's the Three Doctors. When Troughton turns up in Pertwee's TARDIS...
Well, properly speaking, it's a recorder.
Thank you. I was wondering where that had got to. You haven't been trying to play this, have you? Oh, I can see you've been doing the TARDIS up a bit. I don't like it.
Of course.
And this, to me, is very much a Troughton story. It's all menace, it's all style, and then the resolution is nice and quick at the end. But then again, it's not really a story about the Cybermen. It is a story about the Doctor and his companions.
No, that's right. And I suppose we really have to be fair and concentrate on what the story delivered rather than what it didn't deliver.
Right.
Because that can be quite a subjective thing to be, you know, sort of focusing on, I suppose. At the end of the day, we have a story which is really about the Doctor.
Mm.
And really, he makes various references in this story to the conclusion of the God Complex. Right at the beginning there, where Craig basically says, I'm sticking right beside you. Because you're the safest person to be with. And, you know, the Doctor says something like, I remember the old days type of thing, like, those days are over. Being next to me is not safe anymore. And that really seemed to be a reflection on his decision from the girl who waited,
mm-hmm.
that he's ditched his companions because it's not safe to be with this man anymore. He's going down a path that he has now discovered will be... quite bad for him and presumably quite bad for his companions. He is actively distancing himself from those that he knows and loves, even though, you know, characters like Craig are trying their hardest to cling on to him.
But he can't do it. As he walks away from that very halting and strange social interaction, it's like, I'm not noticing anything. I'm not now scanning. I am not now getting involved. I'm really not getting involved, except that I'm going to take a job in a department store. No one could have failed to have missed the reference to Rose inside that one. doing exactly what the Doctor does, playing with technology and inspiring children. That's what it should, that, you know, that's really what it should be.
Wasn't that a fantastic scene where he's outside his TARDIS struggling with will I or won't I? I mean, that was an absolutely beautiful scene for Matt Smith, I think. That really brings it down to what I believe the Doctor is. He's a good man who really wants to help people, not through any self-serving reason. He just wants to be there for people to right the wrongs of the universe. And that scene seemed to really exemplify that perfectly for me.
That's cool. I mean, what did you think about the Clive-Doctor partnership? Well, I say Clive-Doctor, it's Clive-Doctor Stormageddon, really, isn't it? I like that the abstraction of the narrative voice by having a character that doesn't speak, a bit like R2-D2. Saying things and having the other characters interpret what's going on. But I liked the reference between the Doctor and Clive because it seemed to be the same as the relationship between Clive and Stormy. in as much as one of them knows what's going on and the other sort of going along trying to keep up.
It's interesting that you made a quick reference there to this feeling like the story Rose from 2005.
Oh, yeah.
I really got that vibe too. Mm. More so, I felt this was really like an RTD type of script. That we were really getting down to Earthlings at their common level. I mean, that scene right at the beginning with the two department store gals bickering with each other, basically. And, you know...
What, Rose and Martha?
Yeah, well, pretty much. Because she wanted to go on a date and all, yeah, and all that sort of thing. And it really felt like an RTD script. Now, I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or not, because it's wrapped up in the whole Stephen Moffat style and arc. So,
right.
For me, it has so much of the sensibilities of what Russell T. Davies used to write, but done in the Stephen Moffat era.
Right. So, you know, so let's get down to it. To me, one of the things that I perceive about this, it may not be true, but I see this as being Stephen Moffat saying, right, this is the RTD era. This is what it looked like. This is what it did. It's now finished. I am blowing it up and getting rid of it. All this ambiguity about companion, partner, whatever, all this whole gay agenda stuff, all these characters, which were in reality very well rounded, very well acted, and very well written. The ditzy shop girl, the controlling manager, Linda Baron as Val. These are cartoon caricatures by Gareth Roberts, obviously, of the RTD companions and the whole RTD scenario. So even the having it set in a department store, the whole thing seems to me to be a quick sketch of the RTD era. And at the end of it, right, that's it. It's over. It's finished. We're done.
It was so much the RTD era, even down to having the reference to it's okay to have two daddies for a baby. It really is type of feel that you know, we got, well, according to some, we got in spades during the RTD era.
Yeah, according to some people, but I like that this is, to me, this it did mark a watershed, and as much as the production team changed 2 years ago, this, you know, between Gareth Roberts and Stephen Moffat, because they had to agree about this, it does seem to be, right, that's the RTD era. I'm not saying it's an overt thing, but I just picked up on it really, really strongly and thought, well, okay, it's over, it's finished. There's also an Earthshock reference in there as well, because, I mean, I don't know, again, more strange fans like myself may be wondering, that spaceship that crashed, is that the one that Adric was piloting?
Oh, you're kidding!
Kooky theory. Of the week.
Because, I mean, my only other reference for those at home playing the classic series drinking game was a reference to Remembrance of the Daleks.
Oh, go on.
With the teleport in the basement and the doctor thinking he's disabled it, but no, it isn't disabled. You know, they've actually repaired it quicker than he thought. So that was another reference for me, Remembrance of the Daleks. But your Earthshot one beats that hands down. Brilliant.
Well, it's just that it's a crashed spaceship full of Cybermen. Okay, is there a gold star knocking about? And you know, of course, no, it wouldn't, because the doctor took the star with him. But yes, fine. But
wow!
Oh, well done. Yeah, well, like we said, this episode is about the Doctor. It's about the journey that apparently is coming to an end very, very soon for him. He knows what's going to happen when he makes his next journey in the TARDIS. There's quite an interesting air over this episode, despite, you know, the frivolity of the two acts between, you know, Craig and the Doctor.
Well, here's the thing. He thinks he knows. And there's a nice contrast here. Look at what the 11th Doctor does when he thinks he knows when he's going to die. It's completely different to what the 10th Doctor did. But of course, you know, the 11th Doctor has those experiences in his mind. Where the 10th Doctor, say David Tennant, went running across the universe, terrified, running away from it, just like he did in the first incarnation, truthfully. This Doctor, as you rightly say, is like Tom Baker in Legopolis. He knows the end is coming, so he walks toward it slowly, inevitably, and it's so achingly sad. Again, credit to Matt Smith as an actor, because you can see him. I don't know how he does it. From one angle, he looks like a bright, happy young English public schoolboy, and then from another angle, he looks so old and so tired. Mm. I mean, I got flashes of Stan Laurel, but I also got flashes of Bill Nighy from different shots. But again, he's a great actor because, like I say, he just conveys, "I am 1,000 years old." And in my notes here, it says, "As good as Peter Davison was, you know, I'm sure had he been able to, he would have killed for the ability to do what Matt Smith is doing, seemingly so effortlessly."
That fantastic scene he had with the baby, when Craig pops out for milk, you know, that whole thing about, you know, I'm so old, you know, and it really feels like he knows he's at the end of his life. This just isn't a David Tennant you know, I don't want to go end of regeneration. This is the end of my life.
Yep.
And that must weigh a lot more than, you know, the whole four knocks thing from the David Tennant.
Exactly so. You know, this story is being told. You can hear the cloister bell. It sounds like a funereal march towards the end. But even still, we know it's not over because swirling in this whole mass of possibilities is River. River being the key to absolutely everything. So even as the Doctor picks up the four blue envelopes that we see all the way at the beginning of The Impossible Astronaut. In fact, let's talk about that. In The Impossible Astronaut, River pumps a load of rounds into the spacesuit. And then she says, oh, of course not. Which suggests that she knows that she didn't kill him. Because that, the River in that spacesuit, is from an earlier point in her own timeline. And she's still there.
It's interesting, yeah, because, I mean, we now know that there are two rivers on that lake.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, so the older River must know in some way, shape or form that she didn't succeed in really killing the Doctor, that, you know, there must be light at the end of the tunnel.
Mind you, that said, perhaps this is a crossover point. Although old River knows that young River can't be killed because she's there, young River did not experience what happened after she walked back into the lake.
I must admit, though, I'm still very confused about the whole Lady Kevorian plot and timeline, really. I mean, I'm not really 100% on board with it, all that entails, I suppose. I mean, I understand that she and the Silence and, you know, the Headless Monks and all that sort of nonsense want to kill the Doctor,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he's some sort of galactic menace.
Mm-hmm.
But in my head, and I don't think it's really been explained yet, so I hope I'm right. It's not really been worked out yet as to what the full story is with her.
Mm-hmm.
That she wants to kill the Doctor, sure, but I don't think every single part of that's been revealed yet.
No, I think you're right. And again, this is to me the difference between a Russell T Davies finale and a Stephen Moffat finale. I know there are people who think, well, RTD's rubbish. I've got to say, I think he's great in the same way as John Nathan Turner is great. He does. John Nathan Turner is important in Doctor Who history because he keeps a show which many people are trying to kill, defended, and keeps alive for as long as he did. Whether or not you agree with some of the decisions he made in order for that to be the case is, well, neither here nor there, really. You know, my view is always going to be that bad Doctor Who is better than no Doctor Who's, and he kept that show walking for a long, long time. Russell T Davies, love him or loathe him, he brought back Doctor Who. He didn't have to. He and Mark Gatiss did a lot of work to put that show back on the screen. But there is a difference between an RTD finale and a Stephen Moffat finale. RTD is show. The circus is on. The lights are on, there are bangs, there are explosions, there is drama, there is comedy, there's swirling colour, it's amazing. Where Stephen Moffat is more like, hang on, the carpet feels a bit damp. What's that rushing noise? And you walk over to the window and you see a tidal wave approaching. And it's like, and the drama is this oncoming, well, exactly as Russell T Davies would have said, the drama is that of an oncoming storm. As it gets closer and closer, you piecing together bits until you realise what's going on. And the drama is in your own realisation. As Stephen Moffat is on record as saying, you know, it's about feeding the audience enough clues, hiding the solution in plain sight, so they just get it. I mean, the joy of something like Sherlock is that you're going along with it, but you're made to feel a bit like Sherlock when you get it the split second before. Before Sherlock does, you know, that's that, or when Sherlock explains it to you, yeah. that's wonderful. Yeah.
I must admit, Stephen Moffat does it in a much more intelligent way.
Mm.
He does it in a similar way to RTD,
mm.
but what's frustrating for me is I can't say something definitively because
Good.
It may be revealed next year or in the next 6 months. It's difficult to say, well, this is wrong or this is a problem or this has been left unexplained when Stephen Moffat does it in such a way that you're meant to. Have faith in the man and go, well, this might be explained in the next 12 episodes. Don't you start going on about that now. And I've got a funny feeling we're going to be getting that in the season finale too, that we're going to be getting stuff explained, but we're still not going to be getting the full story. So you really can't nail down and say this particular plot element is wrong or this wasn't done correctly, because Stephen Moffat still might reveal something next year. And that's good, but it's also incredibly frustrating and annoying for me.
I think it's great Because I get the feeling that, well, we know the episode's called The Marriage of Riversong, so we know there's, or The Wedding of Riversong, sorry. And there's been a lot of weddings this year, personally, but there we go. I think by the time this whole thing is wrapped up, locked down, and completed, the title of the first story, Silence in the Library, will take on a whole new significance. And I'm kind of hoping that, or I get the feeling that, sorry, when the story is all done and dusted, as it will be in a few short days' time, there'll be a number of middle-aged men and children going back to their season 4 DVDs and ripping out Silence in the Library and going, oh, of course, yeah, oh, now I get it, yeah, of course. Because, lest we forget, whatever happens next week, the river that we first met in the library knows all about it. She's already been through all of that stuff. That was her last story. And now we get to, hopefully this is the last block in the wall which closes all the loops. It's a bit like that piece of a jigsaw puzzle where everything is in place around it and it's not quite making sense. You get the one piece, you put it in, and suddenly it's a picture. I think that's what's going on next week, because if some of the leaks are to be believed, in one scene, River is in her Storm Cage uniform again. So we'll see what goes on there. We'll definitely see what goes on there.
Well, all I can say is I hope so, Tom, because Steve has shown us for a very, very long time that he doesn't really want to tell us everything that's going on.
Why should he?
Yes and no. I mean, I keep thinking of series like Lost, for example, that kept viewers dangling incessantly for, what, 6-7 years? Sure, it's not going to be that long for Doctor Who, but I feel a little bit frustrated sometimes when I'm left dangling for over a year to get the resolution of a plot point, to actually bring final closure to my thoughts on a particular story or on a particular story arc. Mm. Personally, for me, it proves very difficult to give a definitive viewpoint on a story when we're not getting the full story, I suppose.
But, oh, man, perhaps this is one of the last few shows where you can be told a story and strung out in an intelligent way. You're right. Lost, for me, I tried my best with it, and after about, I think it was season 3, I tried a bit of season 4, and I thought, oh, God, just stop. You know, I got bored of it. But with this, I genuinely want to know. It's told to me in bite-sized chunks, each particular story. You know, we were moaning earlier on in the year, oh, we want some standalone stories. We've got them now. But this last piece will make sense of the whole last 2 or 3 years, I think, which I'm really excited about.
It will be good to get that. But I think if Doctor Who took the Lost route and did what the US does and does, what, 24 episodes a year, I think we'd be having the same problems with Doctor Who as we did with Lost.
Yeah.
It's good that, like you say, we get bite-sized chunks. That we've only got 12 or 13 episodes a year, basically. It's harder to get frustrated with it because there are less episodes to get frustrated with, I suppose.
I hear you.
But imagine if we got 24 episodes of this. Do you think you'd have the same patience with it that we are only having 13?
I'm a Doctor Who fan. I would be really patient, you know.
Well, so am I. So am I. But at the end of the day, I want a good story. I want an enjoyable story that I can understand, that I can get some form of beginning, middle, and end to.
All right.
And I've given up on many series in the past because they're not giving me that end bit.
All right. So do you know what? The best comparison I can make personally is between Doctor Who and Torchwood. I can't hack. I've tried. I've really tried. Oh, no, I can't do Torchwood, because for exactly this reason, it's like, what is going on here? Where's the catalyst? What's the story? I can't do it. I should love Captain Jack. I should love Captain Jack. On paper, he should be he's the dirty doctor. He's got a gun. He's got the big coat. He will live forever. He is the doctor, but just a bit dirtier and with a gun. But I can't do it. Something about Torchwood is like, well, yeah, just press that button there and that solves it, doesn't it? Jack, you're immortal. Just kill that off. Jack, you can travel in time. Just sort that out. You've got your companions. You've got the secret base. You've got the James Bond kit. Just sort it out. No, don't take 2 episodes to do it. Do it in half of one. That to me is frustration. Where Doctor Who is more like, there's more like the retelling of a Second World War fable. There's this one man against the rest of the universe. He's ultimately correct. The universe should win on points, but the Doctor does it every time through logic and compassion. That, to me, is far more satisfying, and I could eat as much as you want of that. The only problem is, as you probably know from the news and the web lately, there's strong speculation is that after Christmas, we won't see a new episode of Doctor Who till next October, which is a bit of a problem, but hey, there's 50 years of it to fall back on, and then of course after that, it's 2013. I have had way too much coffee. The next question I was going to ask you was, what did you think of the Doctor's costume? Because it's reset, and I think it looks brilliant.
I love it. I mean, I've loved it for the past couple of episodes. It's been there. I love Matt Smith in a long coat, however that may sound. I think it looks really good. I think it's wonderful that we're getting our Doctor dressed in stuff that is less modern era clothing and less classic series clothing.
Less professorial and more Doctorish.
Definitely. I'm all for that. I've got a funny feeling, though, it's going to be used as some sort of differentiation between certain, what do you call it, versions of the Doctor.
Good.
This is the Doctor wearing the coat. This is the Doctor not wearing the coat, perhaps.
Oh!
You know, similar to what we did with Flesh and Stone.
Actually, there's a problem. You've just reminded me, actually. There's a big gaping hole for me in this. Right, at the end of this episode, the Doctor puts on the Stetson, picks up the blue envelopes, and we presume heads towards Lake Silencio. Yeah? In The Impossible Astronaut, younger Doctor walks out of the toilets and says, "Hiya, I'm the Doctor. What's going on?" Now, that suggests to me that at some point the Doctor was travelling without Amy and Rory. So he's got to be away from them so he can rejoin them. Is that still making sense?
It is, yes.
But as far as we're concerned, the Doctor has been with Amy and Rory all the way along the line. So at what point is he in the toilets in Utah?
Well, does...
Exactly. Exactly.
No. But I mean, we get old Doctor travelling from Craig's place to the toilet.
Yep.
I won't say that. We get the old Doctor travelling from...
It's RTD again.
I know. Gay agenda. We get the old Doctor travelling from Craig's place to Utah, and then he appears out of the toilet, and then he gets killed. No, he doesn't. What am I saying?
That's my point. The old Doctor travels from Craig's place to Utah and meets Amy and Rory, and the Impossible Astronaut starts. So what I'm saying, from what point does the Doctor who's in the toilets travel from? Because he's apparently on his own. Listeners, help me, if you'd like to.
My goodness. So, okay, well, that's very interesting. But we've got two Doctors in Impossible Astronaut that presumably are travelling on their own and re-meeting Amy and Rory. We've got the one that's draped over the car at the beginning.
Yep.
And we've got the one that appears from the diner toilet.
Right, so the one, but that's the thing. I can only see where one of them's from. The guy who's draped over the car with the Stetson.
Exactly.
The one on the car with the Stetson that River shoots off, has just left Craig, presumably, or just left him, but he's just...
Posted the letters.
That's it.
Draped himself over the car.
That's it.
Met up with Amy, Rory and all the others.
Right.
So where does the one that appears in the diner come from?
That's my question. Where's he from?
feedback@thedoctorwhopodcast.com. We probably missed something incredibly obvious, listeners, and you need to let us know now.
Yeah, because we're running out of time. Just like the old man.
Well, I think we have, actually. We've run so seriously out of time. We did have some... feedback we wanted to cover this week, but unfortunately, we actually might leave that till after the series finale, where we'll have a big feedback episode, I think. So, And James will be able to join us for that as well. We really have run out of time. We've sort of deviated quite badly from reviewing Closing Time, but I think at the end of the day, you seem to be quite satisfied with it, but I just seem to be quite dissatisfied because it was not a good use of the Cybermen. And while the other part of the story was interesting, it just seemed to be a disposable way of using the Cybermen.
Do you know what? I think what I'm going to really look forward to is in a couple of weeks' time, so maybe in like October, November time, when we can take some time and go over all these episodes in greater depth, because I liked it as a standalone thing, because what I'm seeing it do is resetting everything just before the final finale. I think this episode had a hard job to do, because it's got to put everything in line for the last 45, 50 minutes, which is going to set everything straight. So I don't see this as a Cybermen story. I see it as a Doctor Heavy story that just happens to have the Cybermen in it.
I'll say it again. I hope it does.
Me too.
I really hope it gives you the resolution that you're looking for in episode 13, because I've got a funny feeling that it's not, that we're going to get the answers to some things, but we're still going to be frustratingly dangled with other things. Well, we aren't very far away. I mean, when you, our wonderful listeners, are listening to this, you'll only be a couple of days away. So please, as soon as the episode airs, get onto your computer and record us some feedback and send it into feedback@thedoctorpodcast.com.
Oh, yes.
Because we'll need all the help we can get to unravel the strands of this season, I think, because, yeah, I'm confused. Tom's a little bit less confused, but still, still slightly confused.
Right, well, it's time for us to wander back into the universe and to circle the Earth until next Saturday. But I'd love to share a song with you. I'm not going to play it. There's a band called Semisonic from a few years ago who had a hit with a song called Closing Time. And there's some great lines in there that could... well, obviously don't, but we can see how they might tie in with this week's story. The lines I'm thinking of are particularly a line that goes...
Closing time... Turn all of the lights on over every boy and every girl.
And then, of course, the refrain is...
Closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Which I think references the Doctor quite nicely. But also there's a line in the second verse, which is gorgeous, which goes...
Closing.
And although clearly this was written while Doctor Who was off the air and the band had probably never even heard of Doctor Who, I think, in a kind of cosy, Thomas very crazy way, I think it fits nicely into this week's episode and podcast.
It does, it does. Even more so, there's another line in there that says, Cybermat with teeth, they're coming for me now. I mean, incredible foresight on behalf of the Semisonic band. See you all next week on the Doctor Who podcast. Thanks for your company. Been a pleasure to talk to you. We'll see you next week, guys, for the finale. Bye-bye.
Take it easy. See you soon.
Bye.
That was the Doctor Who podcast, which you can find at thedoctorwhopodcast.com. If you have any feedback, please send it in to feedback@thedoctorwhopodcast.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and via the Doctor Who podcast forums. Thank you for listening. Take care.